CR Radio series by Data Protection People. I'm joined today by Zara and Phil, who have helpfully decided to support me today in Ali's absence. So welcome to Zara and Phil.
Thank you, Dave.
Hiya.
So how do we find that today? What did we what do we think about the topics that we covered?
I thought it was a good session.
Really great.
Yeah, we covered quite a lot of ground. There was talked about fines, and there was digging into some of the elements in the ICO's newsletter, you know, the anniversary of the Children's Code and things. I found it quite a good session, Zara. How about you?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. I think we got a lot of detail of certain points. You know, it's really interesting to go into depth about the phishing point and struggling with security issues. Also about CCTV and proportionality. I thought it was a really great session.
Yeah, that discussion about the co-op, I really need to pick that up. You know, not here, but you know, that was quite an interesting discussion. I mean, it's a shame we didn't get more input really from people around the country. Because I'm led to believe that the technology being implemented, you know, in the South for a number of months, if not years, and it seems to have only just made it to where I live.
Yeah, enough. Sure. I also like the argument sometimes of just trying to play a little bit of the devil's advocate with that one with the CCTV and kind of go, well, could it be justified in certain circumstances and that kind of thing? Have storekeepers, for example, got the right to make sure that they're not losing too much stock through theft, or that staff and customers are duly protected if there's non-individuals potentially that threaten them?
Yeah, and if that's the best way of doing it, then fine. If barbed wire around all the aisles is another way of doing it, which is better, then so be it. But yeah, interesting debate we had.
For sure. Gun turrets on top of beans, that kind of thing.
Exactly, yes.
So it's certainly an interesting session. For those who regularly listen in, you'll realise Ollie is on his holidays again.
You're meant to say Ollie days. You always say Ollie days.
I was trying to avoid that because Ollie kind of cringes when I said Ollie's on his Ollie days.
Right.
So I was trying to avoid that point, but you'll also realise, and if you're too astute, maybe picked up on the fact that I was busy trying to hold the fort whilst Ollie was away, failing badly, or successfully failing, possibly, if you want to put a positive spin on it. And we certainly welcome him back next week. Is he back next week for the? I don't think he's back next week. I do apologise. I don't think he's back for PCI DSS, which is coming up next week. So we're looking at all things new with PCI DSS, and Phil, you'll be leading on that one.
I will. I'm really looking forward to it, Dave. We've been promising and threatening to do this for some time. The PCI DSS version 4 is obviously published now. It's available as a time frame for implementation, and it contains some significant changes. So I think it's really important that anybody that's kind of processing card holder data, you know, credit card, debit card, prepaid card transactions, you know, they need to be aware of those changes, particularly, I would say, you know, if they self-assess, you know, because they've still got to fill in the new paperwork, which is substantially more than the existing paperwork. And ultimately, you know, processes are going to have to change, systems are going to have to change, and procedures are going to have to change in order to meet the new requirements. So it's vital to get an understanding of them and the intent of those changes in order to prepare, because the clock ticking, and, you know, something like changing systems around, you know, might take a technical project might take a year to run through. So, you know, time is of the essence with this. So I'm really looking forward to the session. Again, we've only got an hour, and there's a lot of changes in the PCI DSS 4. So, you know, I'm not sure that we'll get into intricate detail, but, you know, obviously as a QSA practice, we've got the ability to run multiple sessions and discrete sessions about the PCI DSS, because we're talking from a position of being on the inside of the industry and therefore from a position of knowledge. So we'll do what we can next week in terms of probably overviewing it and food for thought and key changes. But I think ultimately, you know, I've got to go to Milan in a couple of weeks' time for a 3-day conference on it. So, you know, there's a lot in it, and we need to try and, you know, whet people's appetite and, you know, give them the information they need in bite-sized chunks. So that's next week. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's,
but
it's
also next week, Dave, we're doing it our first. We're finally launching our DPO certificate, aren't we? Our internal training program, which you're of course on holiday for. But yeah, again, I'm really looking forward to that. I think we can do a really good, you know, training program over a number of weeks, which is how we decided to structure it, I'm very much looking forward to getting involved in that next week and for the next 8 weeks as well.
Yes, I'm also looking forward to getting involved with that once back from leave and supporting the team with. I think it's a really interesting course and one that I think will be beneficial to many people. So I'm certainly looking forward to that. The PCI I'm really looking forward to. Maybe either after dialing from the holidays, I'll pick it up as a podcast because I'm really interested. Just finally before we go, and the bit that you picked up on and the bit that I was actually going to ask you around the fact that we only self-assess, and if we're only self-assessing, should I take part? And I think you've answered that question well. Yes, you do need to listen. You do need to take part. So if you are at the self-assessment point, please do listen in next week. In that sense, I'm sure there'll be lots more for you to learn and glean from for that. Otherwise, I think we'll leave the listeners now to jump into this week's GDPR radio session. Thanks again to Phil and Zara for joining in, and thanks as always to producer Miles for making sure that we're on time and looking somewhere near professional, at least under Ollie's watch. So thank you very much to the three of you. Good. Okay, just checking. We're not going to get too much feed. So thanks very much. We're just a couple of minutes past. I think we've probably got everybody through. So shall we make a start? I'm here, you're here, we're here. So I think it's a good time to make a plug. So welcome everybody to this week's session of the GDPR radio. I do apologise. We've decided that Ollie's overworked himself and is entitled to a little bit of time off. So unfortunately it now falls into my incapable hands of running the GDPR radio session. So I'll do what I can in Ollie's absence. And we look forward to his eager return after his short period of leave. So as you can see, just going through some of the so those who are new to the session, this is a forum that I'm trying to build. We have built over what feels like a couple of years now, possibly. So we bring a range of topics, range of either specific programs of work, or we look at GDPR radio series as it is today, just looking at news and views and like discussions. But it is your session. If there's any comments, queries, any interesting facts that you want to join in, please do either use the chat function, and one of us will try to keep an eye on the chat, or feel free to unmute, join in and take part in the discussions. You're more than welcome to do so. As you can see on screen, we've got a privacy notice because we will be recording the session. We do put the sessions out as a podcast series, Monica. We do put the series out as a podcast series through producer Miles, so do look out for those, and they'll be available in all good podcast series locations. So that's that for the webinar. Let's and the podcast series. Let's move into some of the topics. We've introduced the fact that Ollie's not here for this session. There will be a bit of a disclaimer. There will be we'll be looking at one of the topics that might be sensitive. It relates to, and we've had ongoing discussions previously around the elements relating to Roe versus Wade, and there's a little bit more coming up in the discussion shortly in those areas. So it's just kind of a bit of an alert to everybody on that one. But as we get started, one of the biggest news is of this week is obviously the death of the Queen, and we all just pay our respects and wishes to the royal family for that. She's certainly a big figure in for the last 70 years plus that she's been reigning for. So we'll just sending our respectful wishes for that. But there's also been some other news. And just before we get into some of the topics, we've got Liz Truss as a new Prime Minister. That was hard to miss with that one coming through with the runoff there with Rishi Sunak. From our point, the Nadine Dorries has handed a notice in from the DCMS, so the Digital Culture, Media and Sports section, in which a lot of our bit sits. And that's now got a new minister in the name of Michelle Donnellan. So I don't know if anybody's come across that MP before. Any thoughts and feelings about how things may change under her guidance? Potentially as a consequence of that, I'm sure some of us may have just picked upon as well that the debt reform bill that was due for its second reading, it is now not going ahead. I understand from reading bits and pieces around the internet that's not taken place to allow ministers time to consider the legislation further. So that leaves you to think, is it actually stopped? Are they going to go further? Did it go far enough? and will we get something, what may come out at the end? So there's a bit of discussion. I don't know if you've got any thoughts and feelings on that one, just before we really get into some of the topics, Phil, about whether the whether this is a new government wanting to strike further than the old reform bill that we've been previously looking at, or whether it stopped in that sense, or whether there'll actually be legislative time to go through the legislative agenda, bearing in mind that Liz Truss has indicated that there'll be a general election in 2024. So it's interesting on that one to see what the changes may be. Have you got any thoughts about that?
I think it'll fall off the agenda, but I think if the Conservatives get back in again, it'll come back. I think that they'll want to change the amend the data protection legislation. That's my feeling. I might be wrong. I mean, look at the Human Rights Act and the Bill of Rights, and what's, you know, they've kicked out Dominic Raab's proposals, but it's not off the table, is it?
No, similar with the Bill of Rights, that's the bill to amend the Bill of Rights. That was also due for its second reading. That now won't go ahead. That, I believe, is for the same reason. In that sense, it may be the fact that the minister wants to have a look. It may be the fact that there's not enough legislative program time left, and they may well have other bits that they want to push through. I think you're absolutely right. I think if the Conservatives get in, then there will be if they don't progress it within the 2 years that they've got until the general election, it will come back post general election, because Liz Truss has certainly been quite vocal, along with a lot of the Conservative Party, about still doing away with all this hanging on with the EU laws and stuff. So it may well come back on, depending what happens in the next 2 years. But that's all happened in the last few days, hasn't it? So it's all quite interesting stuff.
I've been preparing for the training we're doing, starting off our DPO certificate. And one of the key things that I'm trying to get across in the first session, which is kind of the introductory session, the background of the history to the information rights law, is that it keeps changing, and it's changed over time, and its effect is a human construct, isn't it? The law is, it's about, and it reacts and reflects politics and economics and ecology. The law is a human construct, and therefore it's subject to change, and the way it's interpreted is subject to change. And again, we're living in the middle of this. It's a really fascinating time to live with all this kind of change, going on in our branch of the law.
For sure. And it's really interesting, because I was talking to a client in the charity sector, and they were really hoping for some of the reforms that may go through, because it would be beneficial to them, because in the data reform bill, there was an element around whether charities would be caught by the PECA element for marketing, and whether they're going to make it easier for charities to do email communications. They'll still need to have opt-outs and bits and pieces, but do you necessarily need the consent opt-in, that kind of element for marketing through charities? So the individual I was talking to was quite put off the other day with the reform bill being on hold, because I thought that certainly might help with their direct marketing elements. But it's certainly a really interesting time with some of the divergences and where things. And as you say, we're not necessarily just looking at being DPO practitioners looking at data protection law, but looking around other laws that may impact how information is processed, and also being aware of those as well. Anyway, let's move on to some of the points that we want to raise. Zara, I should do the welcomes. Actually, you can tell how rusty I'm at this. We sort of only normally introduces everybody, so I do apologise. We've got Phil back. We've also got the star of the show from last week, which is Zara. So Zara's certainly been, and welcome Zara. Zara's certainly been helpful putting a little bit of a running order together for this, and hopefully we'll have a little bit of input from Zara as we go through. But one of the points that we're looking at initially in the running order, it's another case and sensitive information, because it does relate to the Roe versus Wade case, and it relates to healthcare fertility and period tracking apps in America, and potentially disclosures to American law enforcement for criminal proceedings. Have you come across this, Phil? This is something that Ollie and I have spoken about a couple of times previously.
Yeah, it seems a long time ago. It's only a few months ago, isn't it, when it all kind of kicked off. But yeah, I'm aware of it. I'm really got. I'm aware of it.
You're right. Because in this case, particularly, there was a case where Facebook messages were being disclosed to law enforcement and being used as evidence to assist with unlawful, trying to evidence for whether abortions were unlawful in the US and that kind of thing with the in that sense. But this particular case that we're looking at, the Nebraska police asked Facebook for individuals' private Facebook messages, which showed evidence to help undertake an abortion, which has been used to prosecute the individual. And when you kind of look at these cases, sometimes you can't help asking yourself, is how far is too far? Because certainly you've got some fertility apps that you might think, well, on one hand is a really useful use of technology for individuals, but you wouldn't necessarily on the same score expect that technology to hand or the details from that information to land in law enforcement purposes. So how far is too far in that sense? And have you kind of got thoughts and feelings on how far is too far with, because like I say, on one hand you've got really good use of technology, but on the other you've got to be careful with this privacy impact, this over intrusiveness, and should such information, especially such really sensitive and personal information, whether that should be openly available to enforcement requests.
Yeah, did Dara, I don't know if you've got any thoughts, unless you put it on the discussion chat.
So at the moment it's a point of speculation. Obviously the case in Facebook of the messages being used, that's happened, but with the fertility and period tracking apps, that's yet to have been used, but it's something that it kind of got alerted that actually that's, you need to kind of consider, obviously it depends on where you are, what state you're in America, because not all states have abortion legalized, but it's something to consider when you're using those period apps. Could they be used by law enforcement? Could they ask to request that information out of the tracking apps, and could that be used to press charges against you? It's something that I think for users of the apps, it's something you need to be aware of, that the implications of if you're using these technologies, which are really helpful, as someone who'd want to keep on track of that, it's a great way to kind of be aware of a great way of basically just tracking your what's happening really with your body and all that. So it's something that it feels a bit intrusive, the idea that something that's used for your own personal purposes could be used to essentially bring criminal proceedings against you. So yeah, I think as Dave says, it's definitely something that a DPIA would be great to look into, how you could try and, you know, maintain the privacy of individuals, ensure that if you're using an app that it's got the necessary measures in place to keep your privacy.
And I think that's kind of great points. You're kind of looking at where's the balance between useful and usable tech that may offer a benefit to individuals, not necessarily always looking at tech as being dangerous or tech as certainly having privacy implications, but looking behind that and looking at the protections and where's the balance. So in particular with these particular apps and things, it's looking at whether and from my point of view, I think the DPR would be really interesting to read whether there's one actually been done or not, but we're looking at whether that kind of information could be encrypted or anonymized at device level to avoid kind of anybody other than the device user or the app user to have that really great level of personal detail available to them, and if it was subject to being picked up or shared or used by anybody else, and it's in an anonymized format to help protect identity and that kind of thing. So it's a fair balance. I think you need to have a look at fair balance in that sense and work out where things are. But I think a DPI would certainly have been one to look for in this case to see how the balance privacy implications with that.
Definitely.
In that sense, have you come across through the support desk any interesting DPIs that might have, obviously not from an app point like this in this particular case, but just moving on to DPIs in general, have you had any particularly interesting DPIs, Zara, coming through the support desk that might have some interesting concepts or challenges too?
Good question. Got me in the spot a little bit. I'm trying to think. Obviously, I know Ollie's mentioned in previous podcasts, we've done a lot of work with core reporting DPIAs. And I think that's something that I suppose you can think of. There's a potential that you might need to disclose that information to the police. We need to think about the implications of recording that information. But yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of it off my head. I do a bunch of obviously like CCTV PPAs.
Yeah, I've just put in the chat. I read the article, I think this morning or last night, about Android 13, which is, says it's got features to improve. The idea, I think, on Android 13 is you're going to have profiles, a work profile and a personal profile. And they're trying to make sure that Android 13 can help differentiate the data that's acquired through each profile. And therefore, work can do stuff with the work profile. And it's not related to what we were discussing on Roe v. Wade. But again, this is examples of the technology seeming to move into a better place where, you know, you can protect bits of your data at a corporate level and allow people to bring their own device and, you know, have less of an impact. You can have two photo galleries on your device, for instance, one for your professional profile and one for your personal profile. All these kind of things probably make, you know, kind of device management and data management on devices a lot better.
I was going to say that sounds a little bit like MDM, doesn't it? Like an inbuilt MDM solution into the Android. Was it Android? You mentioned the Android.
Android 13. Yeah.
So therefore, if you've got like an inbuilt MDM, then you could allocate one part of it to a business setting and one part to a personal setting and that kind of thing. Certainly interesting features in that one. It does touch slightly on the bit we looked at last week. I know it's not in the running order, but we touched a little bit last week on the use of facial recognition cameras in retail outlets. I don't know if you picked up on that one, and Ollie tried to do you some justice there the other week.
I was staggered to go into my local co-op, right, which is in a small market town in North Yorkshire. And found that there was that on the self checkouts there was facial recognition, well, the recording going on. I don't know, no privacy notice. You don't know why the recording is going on. But if you walk in front of the till of the checkout, then the recording starts. You know, and there's a like an iPad mounted on it to show what's being recorded, which is obviously you checking out. So I'm going to challenge co-op on that because there's no privacy notice at all about it. So I don't know what they're doing with that information, but I thought it was out. Well, I just wondered what it was all about.
Do you think there's a need? This one, the discussions that Ollie and I was looking at last week, do you actually think there's, could it be justified that you got that kind of footage there because you've got, and the only reason why I'm suggesting that is because there was cases in Australia, I think it is, with Bunnings and another supermarket or another retail outlet that were saying staff are regularly assaulted. There's problems with theft through the supermarket and bits and pieces. So would you actually say there could be an argument? And I'm only playing devil's advocate here, but there could be an argument for some form of technology that would help with staff safety, help with customer safety, help with lessening or reducing staff, product theft.
Well, only if it's proportionate, you know, so what should be happening, if this is a blanket rollout across all stores, I don't think it's acceptable. If there's a shoplifting problem or an assault problem in Stokesley and, you know, this technology is being deployed to prevent or deter it, you know, is that the most appropriate way of implementing, you know, action to prevent or deter that type of behaviour? Not sure. But if it's just a blanket rollout of all this kit across co-op stores, that's not right, is it? I mean, the ICA would say, you know, you got to look at proportionality and look at alternative measures. Certainly, they say that about the use of CCTV, don't they?
For sure. Because it seems like a more of a technical advance. Can you remember the old pub watch scheme, all those the bits in town where they'd have the faces printed out on a piece of paper, and if you got these individuals, be mindful of
they're going to get thrown out by the pub. Do you remember the builder's blacklist? Do you remember that? Well, it must be 15 years ago. There was a builder's blacklist, wasn't there? And any contractors that kind of upset Wimpy or Tarmac or any of the big companies got put on this blacklist. Do you remember that? Because the ICO fined them and banned the blacklist. I don't know if anybody goes, memories go back that far, but similar type of thing, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But it's kind of just, like I say, maybe using modern technology to do the same kind of thing to make it more efficient at spotting these people. It's okay having a list up saying these individuals aren't welcome in the store, and if you found, you'd be thrown out. But they're just using technology to make that a bit easier and a bit quicker, I guess, in identifying individuals that make a match, but just using technology for that process.
Is it right to profile everybody and process everybody's information just to, you know, manage a small problem? Again, it depends, you know, what happens with these recordings, how long are they retained? You know, when I leave the store, if I haven't assaulted anybody, if my recording of me is erased, well, then fine, you know, but that's not how it will work, will it?
No, for sure, for sure. And Charlotte's helpfully put into the chat that it's according to the co-op website, it's for age verification technology.
All right, now how can I try and mess up their system? I have to think on this and see if I can look more youthful. Maybe not. No comments, anybody. Age verification technology. What a load of cobblers.
We've got the link in there. I'll have to follow it. But
what does that mean? If I go through the self-checkout with a bottle of scotch, shave your head. Thank you, Peter. If I go through the self-checkout with a bottle of scotch, the system will evaluate that I'm over 25. Is that what happens, do you think?
I think that's what it's meant to do. It's to make self-checkout quicker.
So they're using facial recognition and other technologies to kind of go, do you look old enough? Then we don't need to then get an adult to check. You can just go through. And if not, then I guess what happens, you just
hide
it and you jack
it. Straight after this, I'm going to go to Stokesley and buy a bottle of gin. And I'm going to see if I have to get the tag taken off the top. So, and my wife's shouting at me. She's saying that it beeps and somebody comes to look at you. If you look under 18, apparently, the system beeps and somebody comes to... Oh, it beeps anyway when you buy alcohol. Okay. Anne's obviously got an alcohol problem, and she's constantly in the Stokesley checkouts. I'll have a look.
I was going to say, if you're waiting there, I'll pop up, and then we'll try it. You going through and me going through, and see if it catches one of us.
Yeah. Anyway, I was surprised to see it in my local co-op. It's not in my village's co-op yet, so I've switched where I buy my gin from.
For sure, but it nicely segues into the next point. And I'm not sure if I've not looked at this. I'm aware of it. I've not looked at it. But have you come across the code of practice in Scotland for the biometric data code of practice for prisons, that kind of thing within the Scottish justice system? So it's a code of practice that should be brought in. I looked into this last week because I was doing a bit of prep for the GDPR session, and we never got around to talking about it. And there should have been a meeting or some kind of approval mechanism from the 7th of September. So a couple of days ago now, so I do need to do a bit of Googling to see what's happening around it. But it's for the benefit of policing that the code addresses current gaps, so it says, in legislation and provides statutory guidance and framework for professional self-assessment and decision-making in that sense, but using biometric technology. If anybody's listening and has come across this, please feel free to join in if anybody's picked up on this biometric use in the Scottish justice system. But I'd certainly read about it. I've just not managed to get my hands on it to dig into the detail and see what's actually in there, or see whether it's actually been passed.
I've not come across it, Dave.
No. Okay. Maybe one for next week. Then we'll see if we do a bit of digging around, see if we can find out what the code's got in there, what it contains, and what it may look like. But it certainly looks. It just feels like there's an increase in use of biometric technology, doesn't there? With whether it's facial recognition, whether it's fingerprint recognition through your mobile phones. I was talking a few months ago, actually, and I know it's a regular thing now. That's even in schools they do fingerprint recognition for the purposes of deducting money from an account for school dinners, that kind of thing.
That's been around for years.
But it's just seen more of it, don't you think?
Definitely more of it.
So it's that was an interesting one. The other thing that's come up recently, which I thought was kind of quite interesting in that sense, was this. And again, I don't know if you caught it. Was the bank fine for enriched profiles? Where I think it was. Which state in Germany was it? I just can't think. There's a state in Germany, and their data protection authority had fined a bank €900,000 for evaluating current and former customers without their consent. And in this particular case, it analysed digital usage behaviour, amongst other things, the total volume of purchases of in-app stores and the frequency used of account statement printers and so on and so forth. And they've been found Lower Saxony. That's it. I was just trying to think off the top of my head which area of Germany it was. But it's Lower Saxony. Fined them sought to fine them €900,000 for that.
Why did they require consent?
I think it's because they were going down that legitimate interest wasn't compatible because the balance of interests wasn't there. I'm not sure if you've got any more on that, Zara, just to bring you back in. But I think it's to do with there's an imbalance with the balance under legitimate interest, I think. Sorry, Zara.
I was going to say, I think it was to do with the fact that they were combining. So you've got the lots of data collected that's then combined and compared with the credit agency and enriched from there. There was no consent for that. And they thought that that was too far to take legitimate interest, I think. Weighing the individual's rights, they thought that, it wasn't sufficient.
All right, we'll have to try and have a look at that. That'll be interesting to read the detail on the decision making.
I think it's because I did read it briefly last week, and I think that was kind of picking up in the elements. I was just trying to kind of work my way through my memory on that one, but it was in relation to the amount of data. And I think one of the findings was the fact that you can't kind of just do it. You can't just kind of gather all that information and start appending information and enhancing the data sets that you've got at will in that sense, because of the size and nature and the scale that they're running it at. In that sense, it wasn't kind of the simple size of appending and updating. I think it's just size and scale, I think. But I do apologise. If anybody's got any additional information on that, then please feel free to unmute and jump in. But I think it was, I think it was more than just simple data enhancements.
Interesting.
So certainly one to have a look at. I do apologise. My second screen's just disappeared, so bear with me for a second.
I think we're going to talk about a Halfords fine, a couple of fine things that have gone through. Oh, that's it's on the end of the list, isn't it? But
feel free to jump in just while I start my second screen up, because I've just lost the running order.
Yeah, well, what did you think, Zara, of the... So this is the age-old problem of no consent. Again, I've not actually read the... I've read a couple of news articles about it, but not actually read the decision notice. I don't know if you have, but...
Yeah, I've looked into it a little bit, and just for context, so Halfords sent nearly 500,000 marketing emails to individuals, and they were fined £30,000 for this. So essentially what happened was the government had a scheme which allowed people to use a voucher of up to £50 towards the cost of repairing a bicycle in certain retailers. And Halfords sent an email encouraging people to book a free bike assessment and redeem the voucher at their chosen stores. So I think Halfords thought, because it's a government scheme, that they were just promoting, they're making people aware of this. And because it was a government scheme, I think they thought that it would be fine to send this out to people. Whereas obviously what they're doing is they're encouraging people to come and use their services. Even though it's free, it's still, encouraging what they offer. So it's still marketing material, and obviously sending it without consent is a breach of PECA if you're going to do it through email. So they were fined, but I see where they were coming from in the sense that because it's a government scheme, you would think maybe there's a bit more legitimacy about that and the message that you're trying to send. But ultimately, if you look at the law, it is marketing.
Yeah, no, that's often the way. I'm just trying to look for other. So another company got fined £80,000 for making 69,000 unsolicited calls. But I'm just trying to get some perspective on it, on, so people who've done like millions and millions of unsolicited emails. I can't remember off the top of my head what kind of levels of fines they've had in the past. But I'm trying to get some perspective. 30,000 for a company like Halfords doesn't sound much. The maximum penalty, I believe, is 500,000 under PECA. But does this seem disproportionately high or disproportionately low, or does it seem unfair? Because we get this quite a lot, don't we? I am promoting a public service, and there is some leeway that in the ICO's guidance for public authorities, but not for private companies if you're promoting something in for the public good, but not for private companies. But ultimately, that's what they're doing, isn't it? But we get this quite often. A lot of people say, oh, we're doing this because we're organising, a Get Fit campaign or whatever. And strictly speaking, that's unsolicited direct marketing.
Yeah, I think maybe part of the reason that the fine was slightly lower was because I think only one individual complained about it of the 500,000. Right. So maybe because there was only one complaint, they didn't seem it to be as as severe as other ones.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I looked into it, and it's about 6p an email, so it's not, in perspective, it's not anything. Yeah.
But it's funny because it says what I'm reading is a Halford spokesperson said the retailer was surprised at the decision as the emails were sent in collaboration with the Department for Transport. And again, there's this expectation the government's joined up, and that because the Department of Transport says this is fine, that it's actually fine. It's always quite funny, isn't it, when you,
there is, I was just trying to look while you're talking about that, because I'd seen a tweet where the Halfords also kind of tied the DPO to it as well. I don't know if you'd seen that, Phil, and I don't know if it's since been taken down, but I did see that one where the Halfords kind of were surprised by the fine because something or other, it also involved discussions with the DPO, and that was kind of a public tweet that went out.
Yeah, Peter's saying they threw the DPO under the bus.
I'd seen that. Yeah.
Under the Peloton. Actually, the Peloton came through, the Tour of Britain came through my village on Wednesday. So the road got shut for an hour, which is quite a spectacle it is. Anyway, carry on. Sorry, moving on.
So I just thought it was, I was just really trying to find it. If anybody's listening in and has an image of the tweet, then please do share it and that kind of thing. So I'm sure, and likewise, Peter, if you got something, because I did see it, I just can't seem to find it anymore, where in a public tweet by Halfords, they said that they're surprised because of this intervention or some kind of support or that kind of element from the DPO. So if you do have it, it'd be interesting just to see it so we can have a look and go through that one.
So
but Pekka finds.
Yeah, here's a question for you. I mean, do you sense any change in the enforcement approach since John Edwards has taken over, or not? Any change in policy, you think? Any change in approach? Any change in the comments made?
There seems to be some additional kind of guidance and some additional kind of information, because Ollie and I've looked at it previously and been quite favourable. Some of the details, I haven't got anything off the top of my head to kind of draw that to, other than looking back through some of our previous podcasts.
I'm just interested in this. Andy Curry, the head of investigations, the ICO, has said not only is it against the law to send marketing emails to text people without their permission, it's a violation of their privacy rights, as well as being frustrating and downright annoying. Halfords is a household name. We expect companies like them to act and know better. And the incident doesn't reflect well on the internal advice or processes, and therefore a fine was warranted in this case. I don't remember kind of reading that emotive language before from the ICO's officers. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I don't read enough.
I can't say I've ever picked up on it personally. It does seem quite emotive. I would agree in that sense. But yeah, it's not one I've really focused on, I'm afraid, in that one. I've looked at some other stuff that seemed quite positive from, like I say, coming out from the ICO in some of the areas that Ollie and I've kicked around. But it's a few months ago now, we were kind of, that's interesting, that's a different concept. And that's felt like a new thing that the commissioner was doing, or the ICO was doing under the commissioner. But it's I've necessarily had a great focus on that one. But whilst we're talking about fines, just trying to move on and through. Did you see that Instagram were also fined, or is it an intention to fine, or fined by the Irish Debt Protection Commissioner, €405 million for handling children's data? Did you come across that? It was another big one that was in the.
I've not seen that.
Yeah, it's we can put a link into the chat for anybody. I'll try and copy that and put it in here for anybody who's got. There we go. So it's another fine by the regulator, in essence, because Instagram is owned by Meta, isn't it? So it's a Meta Facebook company. If they're still using Facebook, another name's changed to Meta, but it's all about how they're processing children's data. And I think it was linked to, and correct me if I'm wrong, Zara, but I think it was linked to children's data that were, and young adults' data that was linked to kind of business accounts on user registration systems and that kind of thing, that would then lead to child accounts being set to public by default. And not necessarily set to private by default. And it's all this kind of element around protecting children in that sense. But it's just another, seems to be another big fine for and this pursuant of Instagram and Facebook and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think you summarised it well. I think there's the reason for the fine is yet to be released. I think it's going to be released next week. But yeah, it seems like, I think this is the biggest fine for Meta as well, so it's quite substantial for them as well.
It'd be interesting because normally, like with Facebook, when there's been issues with Facebook, there's been other regulators then pursuing them. It's not just been like one European regulator. So there was other fines that then led to the regulator in France, like the CNIL and others chasing Facebook as well. I'm not saying I'm a Facebook fan, but it seems to be that there may well be other regulators focusing on certain areas, and there may well be other pursuits for Facebook in that sense. There was something else I've not read into it fully. So I don't know if you've got much knowledge. I know it's not on a little bit on the running order, but it's in relation to, I'd read somewhere, wasn't it? It was Facebook or Meta looking at turning off access to Meta and Instagram and that kind of thing to the Europeans because of something to do with your data transfers and information going to the US. Did I read that somewhere? I know it's not in the running order, but I was just trying to tie it to this a particular story, but I'm sure there was something on that. Again, if you've got some details there, Peter, because like I said, my knowledge on that one is sketchy. I was just trying to draw two bits together. So do please feel free to unmute and join in. You're more than welcome to have a bit of a discussion around that. But they were looking, I think there was a conversation that they were looking, is it coming up shortly where a decision might be made? I think something has happened and a decision might be made and they might be turning Facebook off to all of Europe because of transfers to the US. That kind of thing.
I have not seen that. I'll have to start looking for it now.
So Peter's adding into the chat, it was a threat from the EU due to no adequate transfer mechanism to stop all services. To correct this, a Meta threatened to stop all services because there's no adequate transfer mechanism in place for the transfer of EU citizen data to the US.
Right. Did you see Intercontinental Hotels Group had a technological outage on Tuesday?
I think saw that one.
Yeah,
I saw that one because they used Holiday Inn as the image for that, and I thought, was it Holiday Inn? But then I'm sure the article said it was the Intercontinental Hotel Group. So I don't know if it's a Holiday Inn section of that or whether the image was just tying. Holiday into that chain, but yet another cyber attack.
Yeah, it seems like they've had only 15 compromised employee credentials, but potentially up to 4,000 compromised users. So seems that it was a phishing attack. It looks like that's what seems to have happened. But again, the details are a bit sketchy at this point in time.
For sure, just need a bit more detail. I've seen the headline news again for that one with the IHG group. Do you think we're coming a bit kind of desensitized to cyber attacks? Because there seem to be quite a few, don't there? There seem to be kind of a regularity. Do you think people are getting kind of, oh, it's just another cyber attack? Do you think people are taking them seriously?
I don't know. I think people still take them seriously. Another article I read, I think last night, is that there's something called MooBot, which is a malware bot, which has been around since last year. It seems to be re-emerged. It seems to have been through some re-engineering and is back, focusing on targeting D-Link routers, apparently. But I don't think that people are desensitized to them, Dave. I don't think so. I mean, the big question is, you know, how do you continue to guard against the ongoing developments? There's phishing attacks all the time. I mean, I think the defense mechanisms are getting better. You know, there's more and more. We very rarely get spam through our spam filter these days, but they still come through, don't they?
Well, they do. And I think there was a report out, GCHQ, one of the cyber attacks report that suggested the biggest and the easiest way for cyber issues and ransomware attacks to get into an organization is actually through email. It's still through phishing emails and dodgy links and that kind of thing. It's not necessarily through, not saying it's impossible, but it's not necessarily all of it through hacking your system. It's just from simple emails and individuals clicking on links and all that kind of thing.
It's just more efficient, isn't it? It's much more efficient to launch an attack like that than it is to try and, break into somewhere and break into the data. It's like, it's a lot easier to steal financial data through, like skimming attacks than it is to go and rob somebody's house. It's less risky, isn't it?
So if we're looking at just phishing emails, then how do you change the culture towards phishing emails if individuals are still falling for it, organizations are still being susceptible for it? Is the phishing only in one element? Is there any kind of element of hardening the software behind that once somebody's clicked the link, or is it just awareness and better spam filters?
I think you're not going to like this. My personal view, which I could probably get a load of aggravation now from everybody, is that I think that organizations, this culture about, you get an email in your inbox, you must attend to it straight away, and that leads to people rushing things and not considering things and rattling up replies and opening things that, without really much consideration. Everyone, in my opinion, seems to be such a rush to get their emails clear and their inboxes clear and respond to things, being seen to respond to things in a timely fashion. I read my emails twice a day, once 7 o'clock in the morning and once 6 o'clock at night. And if anything lands in between, I might review it as it flashes up. And if it looks urgent, I'll go and read it. But in the main, I just absolutely ignore it all until I've got time to go through it in a structured way, so it don't interrupt what I'm planning to do for the day. Now, that means you miss out on things. And maybe there's this worry about, I'm missing out on things. But I said you won't like it, that people are so hell-bent on being on their emails. And because you're hell-bent on being on top of your emails, I think you're busy, distracted and rushed, my view. As I say, I'm old school, but there you go.
Do you think that's the element, isn't it? Because it's in order for the email to work. Well, it is. In order for the email to work, the wanting to catch people slightly off guard, they're wanting people under pressure because they want people to respond without thinking, don't they? They don't want somebody to sit there and go, oh, my boss doesn't normally have spelling errors when he emails me. I wonder if he's... You know what I mean, in that kind of sense, or anything else that might give the game away between the one people kind of go, crikey, I've got this, attachment. And I need to respond.
Yeah, an attachment, .html, or HTM. Why would you click on that? It's not an invoice attachment, is it? It's not a PDF. It isn't something that you know it's going to be malicious, or you should know it's going to be malicious. And anything like that is, just take a couple more milliseconds of care, to read it. And maybe if you're going through the emails over the course of the day, you see a pattern emerge. But if you're rushing to deal with it all, as I say, people probably don't agree with it. But I think that's a contributing factor.
So do you think people are just trying to be too helpful at times? Because the reason why I'm saying that, and the kind of, I need to respond because I'm trying to be helpful in that sense, because I've come across it several times recently. I don't know if you've heard of this new kind of, it's new to me. I've heard of it several times, 4 or 5 times in the last 3 months, where an individual's on holiday, but the HR department or the payroll department gets an email saying, I've got a problem with my bank account. Can I change my bank details?
We saw that. One of our customers had a breach 2 weeks ago on that. Exactly.
And it's been an active, it's a positive campaign because the individual successfully changed bank details maliciously and diverted a salary payment from the individual who's intending for it to land on to a different account. In that sense, so it's a successful campaign from the individual behind it. And the employee, when they came back to work, just kind of went, well, I've not been paid, and then it all came to light. But I've seen that four or five times I've seen that. And there's been due process internally that, you need to log on and self-serve through whatever system they're using. And the argument came out, well, I can't access that for whatever reason. Can you just make sure that it goes through this kind of thing? And, on this occasion, I will. And I just wondered whether there's that kind of element of, I'm just trying to be helpful. And I thought it was a person, I'm just trying to be helpful, not necessarily sat there querying, should that individual do that? That kind of thing. So I've heard of it 4 or 5 times, like I say, in the last 3 or 4 months where this has occurred. And there's been due process in the background. But it's just due process hasn't been followed.
Yeah. I think, this comment here has just landed. Oh, it's gone now. I clicked on the wrong thing. About just it's exploiting human behaviour, isn't it? Human frailties, human faults, whatever they are, not even with time, being overworked or whatever it is, poor tools we've got to work with. But it is, and you know, if your business was hacking, not protecting against hackers, you would be as inventive and creative in your field of work as you are in our field of work. So you'd be always looking for new ways of running exploits.
No, for sure, for sure. And like I said, for me, it's because I've heard it through several people. Some heard it through some clients, and I've also heard it externally with friends and contacts where it's come up in other places. But it's I just wondered, yes, there's this element of you may be pressured, you may be trying to respond, but this element of I'm just trying to be helpful, they've asked for this, so let's, it looks like legitimate, it looks like the person that it should have come through, and it's just that element of not necessarily always being rushed, but just that I'm trying to be helpful kind of approach. Maybe I'm wrong, but I thought there was a particular point in there as well.
I don't know if you saw that on the ICO's newsletter. Sorry, Zara, I'm going to change topic, but I won't. About them, a new certification scheme they've approved. Sorry, you were going to say before I jumped in.
Sorry, I was just going to say as well, I think it's also just good to always just bring awareness of these risks to people's attentions. Because as you say, I think people go into it thinking with their best interest, thinking, oh, I'm just trying to help this person. But if you make people aware that this is a risk that does happen, it's becoming increasingly used, then it might, when they see it happen, they're aware of this risk, and they're less likely to kind of just feel like, oh, I'll do this. They're more like to follow the procedure to ensure that they're handling it the right way.
For sure. It's very similar to the internal phishing. Have you been involved in any internal phishing campaigns, Phil? Have you seen those?
Yes.
Phishing campaigns, that kind of thing?
Yeah, very, very good. Yeah.
Do you think they work? Do they...
Well, the evidence I've seen from doing audits is that they always have, if they're sustained, there's always people that click on them. Again, in my experience of auditing, but what I found is that in general, the number of people clicking on them goes down over time. So I think I've got evidence, you know, it's not a representative sample across the world, but what I've seen, they do appear to have some impact. Yeah.
When I've seen them, what's staggering for me is the number of individuals that click on it and then further click and provide details. If you look at, like you do with email marketing, if you look at your open rates and your click through rates and your that kind of thing, just a high number of, well, percentages, that kind of thing, where you sometimes getting in excess of 50-60% of the organization all looking at the email, and then a further quite high percentage of those that opened it, how many then went on to provide the login details and things. And sometimes that's a kind of a bit of an eye open, especially if you follow it after some training on.
Well, and have you seen, or has anybody on the session seen, you know, the evidence of a reduction in, you know, clicks over time through a repetition of this type of exercise? I mean, that's what I've seen doing the audits. You know, I've actually seen evidence of this, you know, but I don't know if anybody else got any experience.
Just on your figures there, Phil, have they taken it to kind of, is there a core department or individuals that are kind of, shall we call, repeat offenders?
And I don't there are, mean there to, are, yeah. There are patterns that emerge,
And trying to identify what those patterns are and why, and whether there's kind of specific training for particular teams and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Again, what I found doing quite a few audits recently is that this type of service is contracted out, so it's a third party providing the phishing exercise, and therefore, you know, the brief is make sure you get lots of statistics to report on, so they know who's you know, clicked and how far they've gone, and you know, there's some statistics to analyze, and therefore they can identify repeat offenders. And you know, again, what I found is that those repeat offenders get put on additional training, so you know, this is about strength in depth, isn't it? Multiple approaches to fix that problem, and you know, the retraining and the tool set, and you know, the force people to do retraining are all, and measuring it is key. If you don't measure it, you don't know whether you're improving or not the situation.
No, for sure. Sorry, before we start talking about phishing, you were going to introduce something else for you, I think.
Well, I was going to say on the ICO's newsletter, was it last week or this week? I just noticed that they'd approved a new certification scheme. So I had a quick look at it, and it's a certification scheme for basically for cleaning media. So, you know, there's a standard now for, there seems to be a standard for destroying and or cleaning media. So it's the ICT asset recovery certification. So this is enabling people to, you know, reuse assets, having had them cleaned, I think, from reading through it. But there's not many certification schemes out there, which is why it caught my eye.
I'll put you on the spot. Then what are the other two?
Well, one's the age-appropriate child verification, isn't it? So that's one. And the other one, I honestly can't remember off the top of my head.
So is the standard produced? It'd be interesting to read through what the technical standards are for that one.
Yeah, I put a link into it in the chat. It's a standard you can go and download and read through. And again, these are quite interesting to read, where they're structured and, you know, the level of the requirements. I always find them quite interesting to read and then compare to other things. Going back to the PCI.
Being a bit of a circular argument, then, do you find that the guidance is getting any better under John and the new direction of the Information Commission, or do you think the guidance is still following the similar format as previous?
It's too early to say. I mean, again, in preparing this, our DPO training course that we're doing, I've been ensuring that all the materials we're going to distribute to the participants are the absolute latest. And I'll tell you what, Dave, what a nightmare trying to find out what's the latest, even in variations in versions, as we talked about yesterday, of the Keeling schedules of the Data Protection Act and the GDPR. You know, that there appear to be different versions that you can access if you Google it. Even on the ICO's website, you're often referred back to out of date and old versions of documentation. And what you can get, some of it you can download as PDFs and some of it you can't. So I think it's far too early to tell. I still have a real problem personally, you know, using their website. I much prefer it's all right having hyperlinks if you're just trying to get quick answers. But if you're doing in-depth research and you're diving about all over the place and losing the thread, I find that really hard.
No, I would tend to agree with that, because I've kind of developed my own little library with some resources and some resource material in there, but I struggle now to download anything. To if I wanted to print it off and read it and maintain it and things from the ICO's website, it doesn't seem to used to get like the front cover with it, and used to get different colors and different guidances and things like that for the front, because I don't seem to see any of that anymore.
There's the guide to the GDPR is still a downloadable 343 page document with change control in the front, which is good and it's useful. And it generally reflects the websites. You obviously, if you're downloading something, you got it in hard copy, you just got to make sure you keep on top of changes to it. But you know, having it all as hyperlinks, and there's not as much detail. So some of the time, it's summarizing something and says, for further information, click here. But it takes you somewhere else then, doesn't it? So that's why I find it quite tricky to work with, because it takes you somewhere else. You think, oh, that's not actually relevant, or I need a bit more detail, or I need less detail. Now, where was I? You know, I just find it hard to. So I prefer to get a copy of it, or, you know, as a PDF, annotate it myself. Again, you can't annotate easily a website, can you?
No. But I still like, I'm still a bit old school. I still like writing my notes in the edges and kind of tying bits and pieces together with manual documents. It's possibly just my age, but I do like to, if it's more than a couple of pages, that kind of thing, I do like printing it off and playing around with it and drawing on it and scribbling bits out and that kind of thing.
Yeah, but it's good to keep this stuff as well. I was clearing out some of my cupboards last week when I was on holiday. Don't ask me why, but I was. And I came across a whole load of stuff from a long time ago, which was a lot of registrations, you know, the old registration of data controllers. I mean, really old stuff, like all the forms you had to fill in, the purpose forms and the change forms. And I'm going to use that in the training, because I think that's really informative. You think, well, that's what is this ROPA meant to be replacing? You know, to me, a lot of it is enhancing accountability, but some of it is replacing the old register. And if you think about what detail was in the register and how information was recorded in the register, the ROPAs are really similar. You know, classes of data subject, classes of recipients. I think the answers are all there back in the old notification handbook from the 2001 or whenever they published it. So I think, you know, if you understand, which I'm sure everybody here does, if you understand where the law has come from, it's a lot easier to then contextualize it for where we are today. And that registration process, you know, went through a number of changes. First off, it was incredibly detailed, and it ended up being incredibly superficial. You know, like you don't have to put anything down apart from if you're CCTV and two other things, like checky boxes, weren't they? So how much information, you know, does a member of the public get from looking at the old register? Well, not much, really. But in the old days, you used to get chapter and verse.
Well, you could argue that with the new ROPA, couldn't you? Because if you looked at the new ROPA in order to be compliant in that sense, or let's say the new ROPA, at least the records of processing activity under the UK GDPR, there's only points A to G in there. And as you know, in points A to G, there's nothing in there about lawful bases of processing. But most ROPAs usually have columns in there about lawful bases of processing within them.
Yeah, I think that's kind of an oversight of the GDPR, but you know, because the principle is, you know, specified explicit legitimate purposes. Well, where are they specified? Well, in the ROPAs seems the obvious place to specify them, and sure, in the privacy information. But it should, I think it should be in Article 30. Anyway, we're going down a academic rabbit hole, aren't we? Which is fine, because we quite enjoy going down like academic rabbit holes, don't we?
Some of those moot points that we can talk hours about, aren't they, really? In that sense. Just coming back to Zara then, because just trying to bring you back. And is there anything else from the news that we've seen? Anything else that might be interesting? We've got just a couple of minutes until we hit the 60-minute mark for our podcast. Although I'm sure we could talk longer if we wanted to. Is there anything else that you'd seen in the news recently, Zara, that you wanted to pick up and have a short 2-minute chat about?
Yeah, there's the DCMS cybersecurity findings, where basically they just concluded that cybersecurity is a significant growing risk. I mean, we kind of talked about it earlier with phishing emails and what's going on there, but it seemed like what they were saying, there's not enough resources that really been putting into cybersecurity, and that is more of a reactive response from organizations than a proactive response, which is obviously where you can get some risks. Obviously, if you're being reactive, you're on the back foot because you're waiting for something to happen that's going to go, oh no, we need to update this. Whereas if you're taking a proactive approach, then you're already prepared for the changes of technology, which obviously, as we all know, is constantly changing. So I think that was quite an interesting finding, but it's something I think that probably is a bit, I think we were all kind of aware of, I would say.
Yeah, there's probably bits in there saying it's would you say it was a growing threat, so growing something rather. I think some of that is kind of self-evident. I think we could probably get there. It's interesting to see that I think this more more reactive, I think you said, than proactive in that sense. Did they give an indication as what that might be? Is it organizations just not really investing in cybersecurity sufficiently enough until there's been an issue and kind of addressing kind of as an afterthought, going, oh, we now need to do this, and suddenly money being available? Or did it kind of indicate why that might be the case, why the approach to cyber is a bit more reactive?
Yeah, I think, well, they touched on, I think it was more towards smaller businesses who wouldn't necessarily have the resources to maintain a proactive approach, whereas the larger ones are probably obviously would have more resourcing to be able to fund that. So I think that's probably one of the key issues and struggles that they have.
For sure, because you often see with kind of cartoons and comical bits about how much money is available prior to a breach and how much money is available to address things after a breach and that kind of thing. So I guess the DCMS's report there, or their reports maybe just slightly reflects that, I think.
Yeah. And then another point, which it's, to be fair, it's been a bit contended, because there's allegedly been a TikTok data breach of 2 billion records is what users claimed. But then TikTok have come out saying that there's been no evidence of a security breach. So that's interesting point. We'll see obviously what happens with that, but something to keep an eye on, because obviously 2 billion records is a huge amount of data if someone's got that and what they could do with that. So, yeah, interesting to see what happens as a result of that.
You'd have thought if somebody's kind of taken or lost 2 billion records, you thought it's a sizable amount, isn't it, as a file size. I think I'd seen somewhere that that TikTok were suggesting or recommending people change their passwords and have some form of dual factor kind of authentication in place. I wonder whether that's just as a part and parcel of a measure to protect the systems further, as we've got to kind of be seen to be doing something, and you can take this kind of protective measure to look after yourself, or whether that indicates that they're not aware if anything's happened. But if it had, then it may well be more through credential stuffing, through username, and well, because people are. Individuals are subject to being lazy, and we've all got multiple passwords and multiple systems that we need to log into, so we all use the same username and password, don't we? That's where the idea of credential stuffing comes from, where you've got your same kind of credentials across many different platforms. And I wonder whether that's what's at the heart of that one. But it's certainly one to watch, I would have thought, especially because just by the sheer amount of number of records that they're talking about, 2 billion is quite a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, that's probably got us to about the hour mark, and we normally try to keep it within there. Is there anything, any kind of final thoughts, any kind of lasting comments you got to make there, Phil, before
no, we draw no, the session to an end? We could do another hour of talking. I was going to, the children's code is a year old. ICO says, you know, that it's made a big impact, and give some good examples, actually, of the impact it has had. I just wondered if anybody, you know, we haven't got time to discuss it. But anyway, that was interesting to have a look at. And there's quite a few other bits and pieces. You know, a couple of health workers who've been fined, in fact, prosecuted for stealing and misusing data.
We looked at that a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah,
we looked at that a couple of weeks ago. But I think, I'm sure mine was all correct. Is it a GDPR radio session again next week?
It's not, but Phil is joining us again on the 23rd of September for another episode of GDPR Radio. Next week's episode is PCI DSS 4.0, and going through the changes. So it'll be Phil and Jasmine will be on air next Friday on the 16th, same time as always, to discuss the PCI. And then the following week on GDPR Radio, we'll probably catch up on anything that we've missed today. So I'll get the invites out for PCI DSS later on this afternoon, and the invites for GDPR Radio on the 23rd will come to you some point next week.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. So that's basically looking at, you know, the PCI DSS is changing, has changed. There's a deadline now for when people have to comply with the new standard, which is end of March 24. But, you know, there's a lot of work to do to change processes and potentially systems and IT, and therefore, you know, we need to be aware of what those changes are now and how they're going to affect us now, because we need to start putting a project plan together to start shifting around, you know, what controls we've got to, you know, and evidence we've got to meet the new standard. So I'm looking forward to that. Should be a good session. Hopefully it'll be a good session anyway. We shall see.
I'm sure it will be. So we'll look forward to that when it'll be pushed out on all the usual channels. If you can't attend the live sessions to raise questions and to interact with the team on that one, then following that will be another GDPR Radio series. So if there's any news and views, any bits that you see in the that may be useful for us to talk about, or indeed elements that you'd like us to add to a growing list of specific topics, please do try and get in touch with us through the multitudes of means or emails. And get in touch with Miles around some of the topics that you'd like us to discuss moving forward. But otherwise, that's kind of bring it to, we'll bring that to a close for today. Is there any lasting comments you need to make yourself, Sarah? Any thoughts or takeaways?
No, I think it's been a really interesting discussion, but I think we covered a lot. So yeah, it's been great.
And you're on a holiday next week, Dave?
I am, and bearing in mind what I said about the people changing payroll details and stuff, my bank details are fine as they are. Thank you very much. Okay, shutting in the next 2 weeks if anybody comes in, it's wrong.
Right, okay, just bear that in mind.
So yes, I'm on leave for the next 2 weeks.
So
thank you very much. Thank you to you and Zara for joining. Thank you to everybody else who's listened in today. Apologies, I've not polished my comparing skills as well as Ollie in that sense. I've tried badly and failed excessively easily with comparing that one. So thank you very much for duping it. We will welcome my Ollie back after he's had his leave. He seems to have a natural flair for this kind of thing. But thank you very much for taking part. If we don't speak to you beforehand, and all the best to everybody. Have a great weekend, and we'll catch you next week for PCI DSS 4.0.
Bye, brothers. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.